We don't, in the Western world, tend to worship idols. But if you go to India or the Far East, you will see people worshipping idols pretty much everywhere. And people are often shocked when they go there for the first time. And I remember Natalie King, a couple of years ago, went to Taiwan. And she couldn't believe the number of people she saw visibly bowing down and worshipping idols in their homes and on the street corners. It was just normal there. Okay, well, you might say, yes, but surely in our culture it isn't a problem. This is one commandment we don't have to worry too much about. People are not so much polytheistic as atheistic. They don't worship many gods. They hardly worship God at all. Well, let me tell you the story of the two young fish who are swimming along, and they meet an older fish who's swimming the opposite way. And the older fish, as he passes, says to them, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" Two fish swim on for a while, and then one turns to the other and says, "What on earth is water?" Robert Beller was perhaps the world's leading sociologist of religion until his death in 2013, and he wrote a book called Habits of the Heart about what modern Western people believe. And he said, people today feel that no one has the right to tell them what to believe. They have the right to shape their own worship, their own faith, to worship the God they prefer. He called it expressive individualism. And that is pretty much idolatry, isn't it? Creating your own God. I decide what and how I worship. So I want to suggest to you that at the heart of idolatry is something deeper than making a statue. At the heart of idolatry is worshipping and serving something other than the real God. And so we need to ask ourselves the question, what am I really living for? What is driving me? You may believe in God and go to church, but if anything other than God is functionally more important to you for your happiness, your identity, your hope, and your meaning, then that is what you're worshipping and serving. That is your God. So idolatry is not so much doing bad things, it's taking something good and making it the ultimate thing, the thing that really matters, taking a relative thing and making it absolute. It's saying, I believe in God and he's very important, but if I could only achieve that, if I could only get this, then I'd be somebody, then I'd matter, then I'd be safe, then my life would really be the way I want it to be. And whatever that is, that's your idol, the thing that you worship and serve. We're familiar, aren't we, with people whose lives are controlled by alcohol and drugs. And we can see that addiction is a form of idolatry because people end up serving those substances and depending on them and being controlled by them. And we know that that's bad. But most idolatry is not really like that. It's much more subtle than that. It's taking a good thing and making it the ultimate thing. Family, your parents' approval, or the success of your children, career, money, achievement, acclaim, your looks or your partner's looks, your moral record and goodness, some good cause that you believe in. If that's what gives me meaning and gets me out of bed in the morning, then beware. And I guess what we sometimes miss about the idols in the ancient world is that each of those gods had a job to do. There was a money god, and a work god, a sex god, a god of the arts, a god of war, a god of play. They had a purpose in people's lives. That's why they worshipped them, to get something. And those people were just honest and overt about something that we do without realizing it. They were conscious and explicit about something that we're unconscious of. What is water? Said one young fish to the other. Well, that image comes from a famous speech at Kenyon College in the US by an American writer called David Foster Wallace. And he wasn't a Christian. In fact, he committed suicide a few years later. But he went on to say this to the graduating students. He said, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. The insidious thing about these forms of worship, he said, is that not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They're default settings. They're the kind of worships, the kind of worship you gradually slip into every day without even being fully aware that that's what you're doing. End of quote. So any relationship, any activity can be turned into a kind of idol, something we're looking to for our salvation, the source of our hope and meaning. Of course, we don't use those worship language terms, but in fact, we are serving them, aren't we? And they end up controlling us, those created things. I had a friend who was a youth worker with teenagers, first in Liverpool and then in central London. And he said it was interesting the way the idols were different. In Liverpool, the idol was fashion, having the right clothes, being in with the right crowd, and being seen as cool. In London, he said the main idol was not fashion, it was education. Going to the right school, getting the right results, getting into the right university, getting the right job. That's what makes me somebody. And in London, work and career easily become gods, don't they? We worship and serve them and they control our lives. Someone said children are being sacrificed on the altar of those gods all the time as they grow up with parents who are always busy, always out, always distracted. And so idolatry, whether we recognize it or not, is the water we're swimming in, isn't it? Taking something other than God, taking a good thing, and yet making that central to our identity and happiness. And if you've got any self-knowledge, then I think you will have seen something of yourself in this. It's not the second commandment by accident. It's fundamental and relevant to all of us. Why do we do it? I'm sure the evolutionary biologists can come up with an explanation about the survival of our genes as they can for everything. But as a Christian, I want to say we do it because we're created to worship something outside ourselves. And so if we don't worship the immortal, beginningless God, we will worship something in creation. John Calvin said that human nature is a perpetual factory of idols. If you seek ultimate meaning in anything in the created world other than God, the problem is you place an impossible burden on it. It can never carry that weight. David Foster Wallace, not a Christian, as I say, but it's extraordinary. You can Google this very easily, and it's fascinating to read. Extraordinary how he saw this so clearly. He said, an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some sort of principle, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in your life, then you will never have enough. It's the truth. You'll never have enough, he says. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, I'm still quoting him, and you will feel weak and afraid, and you'll need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect and being seen as smart, and you'll end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. See, he recognized that idolatry is all around us, and we worship these things. Let me give you another example. Romance. In a world without God, we have come up with a romantic solution as a way of fulfilling our lives, of knowing our existence is not pointless. You know, the love partner becomes this perfect, ideal person into which we invest our lives and ourselves. All of our spiritual and moral needs become focused on them and having the perfect relationship. And that's where I'll overcome my feelings of inadequacy and insignificance. Somebody called it apocalyptic romance. But of course, no one can bear that. The reason I suggest that marriages fail is not so much that we expect too little from them, but that we expect too much. We think this person's going to give us everything we need, and they can't do that. And if you rely on them for your salvation and your redemption, then you'll crush them with your expectations, and they will devastate you with their imperfections. So when we reflect on idols and idolatry and this instinct in our heart to worship something, we find that there's a strange paradox about it, about idols. On the one hand, they're incredibly powerful. They control our lives. We serve them, and we can't escape from that. But on the other hand, they're pathetically weak. They can never deliver the things that we ask them for. As the psalmist says, they have mouths but cannot speak, ears that cannot hear, eyes that cannot see, etc. Your career won't save you. It doesn't even care about you. A week after you leave the building, you'll be forgotten. That's true, isn't it? You give your life to this. I remember I spent years in the city. Nobody cares about when you're gone. Life just goes on without you, let's face it. Your children don't want the burden of fulfilling your dreams. It's unfair on them, and they'll try and escape from it as soon as they can, if they've got any sense. And you'll never find the perfect partner for your apocalyptic romance. And if you do, you'll crush them under that burden. Idolatry is taking a good thing, but making it into the ultimate thing, and nothing can bear that burden. And as David Wallace, Foster Wallace says, it's the kind of thing you just slip into without even realizing it. Well, let's take a real example. Me. Where do I get my security and my identity from? Do I get it from the invisible God who I can't see, who I don't hear speaking to me audibly? Or do I get it from the visible things all around me, where there are a lot of people in church on Sunday, where the people come up to me afterwards and say, that was a lovely service, Vicar. Whether someone says, that was a really helpful funeral you took. I mean, do say those things if they're true, because we all need encouragement. But if I need to be careful, don't I? Because it's much easier to depend on that than to depend on God. And if you depend on those things, then you'll end up insecure all the time, always saying, how was the service? Was it okay? And if someone says to you, it's boring, you'll say, what? What do you mean boring? Why was it boring? You'll get over defensive because you're depending on it for your very identity. And that's a sign to us when we're really defensive about things. It probably means we're putting too much pressure and importance on them. The 19th century Danish philosopher Kierkegaard told a parable about a prosperous man who's traveling in his carriage at night on a dark but starry night. And he has all the lanterns in his carriage lit. And he feels safe. He fears no danger, says Kierkegaard, because he carries his light with him. But precisely because he carries his light with him, he cannot see the stars. The poor peasant, on the other hand, walking along the road in the darkness, can see the stars with great clarity and can see where he's going by the stars' light. That's the parable. The man in the carriage, feeling safe, carries his light with him, but because of the strong light, he cannot see the stars. If we're building our identity on something other than God, something near to us, then it feels comfortable and safe. But actually, it's vulnerable, isn't it? Isaiah said, if you hadn't nailed your idol down, it would have toppled over. And our idols, like our career or our job title or our bank balance or our children's exam success, are very fragile. They can topple over just like that. If you depend on what you see in the mirror, then every time you look, you'll be more anxious about getting older. You're always on edge. Only the eternal God can keep us safe and give us that eternal security that our heart longs for. But of course, that light's much dimmer than the light right in front of us, isn't it? And there are so many bright lights around us that demand our time and attention all the time. Vicars always feel bad about telling people to come to church, but it does seem to me that we have to deliberately carve out time and make church a priority. Because if we don't, then all the other things will seem more pressing and more urgent. You know, I've got to get my child to do that sport, or I've got to see that family member. Unless you really decide church has got to have time and make time for the things of eternity, inevitably they will get lost in all the bright lights around us. Well, how do we, my time's running out too, so how do we get these things in their right place so that they're good things, but they're not the ultimate thing? I think there's an unlikely word in the second commandment that can help us. Let me just read it to you again. You shall not make for yourself any idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters below, so anything in creation. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who obey me. Well, the unlikely word is the word jealous. When I was a curate, there was a man in the old people's home we visited, and every single time we went, he said, "It says in the Bible that God is a jealous God. How can God be jealous? That's ridiculous." And of course, we think of jealousy as an unattractive emotion, don't we? But suppose my wife, Catherine, had a picture in her purse of another man, and she often took it out and gazed at it lovingly. And every night before she went to sleep, she kissed it tenderly. How would I don't think she does that, or she keeps it quiet if she does. But how would I feel? You know, I'd be angry, I'd be jealous, it'd be deeply frustrating to have this inappropriate relationship going on in front of me. You know, if I didn't love my wife, I might not mind. Well, who cares? That's her thing. But if I love her, then I feel deeply jealous of that relationship. Jealousy is the measure of how much I love her. And that, it says, is how God feels when his people bow down and worship the things around them, the good things he's given them, rather than him, the creator. And that's why we use that strange reading from Jeremiah, which I had to send the children out before it was read, about adultery. Because the main metaphor in the Old Testament for idolatry, for worshipping idols, is adultery. And it's a very graphic image. Israel has committed adultery with stone and wood, Jeremiah says. And the reason for that very powerful metaphor and for the word jealous here, I think, is because God wants us to grasp how passionate his commitment is to his people. If you've put your trust in him, the beginningless, unbounded creator of the universe, then he loves you with an unshakable love. He's jealous if you give your love to anything else. He set his son to set you free from the slavery of worshipping the created things of this world. So don't bow down and sacrifice to your career or your looks or your parents' approval or anything else. We need to gaze at and be filled with wonder and amazement at that love for us, so that it melts us and changes us. And our heart goes out to God in wonder and joy. And if we do that, then people will become just people. Money will become just money. Career will become just a job. Education will become just education. It's a good thing, but it's not the ultimate thing. It doesn't control us. We're not devastated when we lose it. Because those things will pass away. They're not the ultimate things. Don't give your heart and your life to them. Instead, give thanks to God, from whom all those good things come. And worship him with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. Amen.